Every Thursday, we check in with the Indianapolis Star beat writer for Indiana basketball and football. It's our great friend, Zach Osterman, at Zach Osterman on the Twitter, IndyStar.com. And, there's no other place to start, is there, today, my friend? First of all, good afternoon. How are you?
I'm good, Glass. How about you?
I know you've been very busy since late yesterday afternoon. I was at my favorite local watering hole when everybody's phone started popping and blowing up. And it was terribly sad news to hear that Indiana basketball coach Bob Knight passed away at the age of 83. Do I have that right?
That's correct. Yes.
That's just one of those numbers. Coach Knight. And that was not terribly surprising, but the finality of it being the end is, I think that's what hits home here, at least with me. And we've been talking about this all day on the airwaves, and just kind of take me through your evening last night. Mike Woodson gave us a clue at Hoosier Hysteria, right? When he took the microphone, he said, hey, if you guys could all say a prayer for Coach Knight and his family or something to that verse. So the rumor mill had it, he wasn't doing well, but it's still a very sad evening last night and night and into today as well.
Right. I don't think anybody was surprised. Knight had, I think there, it was kind of an open secret that he'd been in poor health, at least in Bloomington. Obviously, there was the, eventually publicly revealed a brief hospital stay back, and I think that was the spring. And, I think he'd also just kind of retreated largely from public life as was certainly his right. In terms of, I think the it felt, it felt like kind of the last, big moment was the coming back in February of 2020, attending the IU game, being there with all his former players and all those people that would have meant so much to him and to whom it would have meant so much to have him there. And then from there, I think, you'd hear kind of these stories about, I saw Bob Knight at the driving range, or Bob Knight was at my son's Smithville Scrappers game. I think very much he and his family wanted that privacy in later life. And again, as you said, I don't think anyone was terribly surprised. And it does feel in some ways like a life worth celebrating as much as a man that many, many people will, of course, miss. But it's, it is for a lot of people. His family, his friends, his former players and assistants and so forth. And obviously just Indiana fans, an understandably emotional day.
The basketball side of things and the interpersonal side of things and the Bloomington side of things, we're trying to cover them all today, but the basketball part of this, he will be remembered and has been remembered even in his later years here, as obviously one of the greatest minds in the history of college basketball, putting the game together, game planning, motivation, and everything else. The three national – we could sit here and do 10 hours on just the numbers of Coach Knight. You wrote something today kind of trying to encapsulate everything around it, and it is complicated to talk about because, well, he was complicated.
He was, and in the same breath, and I talked about this on our podcast, which if anyone is looking for it, has had some technical difficulties. Hopefully it's up by now, if not soon. Some file issues that I'm not smart enough to understand, but he also had a cultural force that I don't think people necessarily appreciate in the way that it's hard to appreciate something from a different time and place. It's hard to appreciate something from a different generation. I could tell you about, what the phenomenon that Tiger Woods was in his prime, but I couldn't tell you about Casey Stengel, if you understand what I'm saying.
I do.
But there are people in the history of all sports, coaches and athletes alike, that transcend not just their sport, but sports in general. And not wanting to take anything away from some of his peers, Bob Knight had that in a way that even some of the other coaches that you would classify as among the best, not maybe in college basketball history, maybe just in basketball history in general, did not. I think there was a 10 to 15 year period in this country where the average American, not the average sports fan, but just the average American, might be more likely to recognize Bob Knight than the vice president of the United States or whoever might be occupying the top spot in the Billboard 100. In a given week, I used this comparison with someone, or this sort of example with someone last night. There was a time at the height of his success and his fame, and whatever you felt about him, you know, whether you believed in Bob Knight, whether you're critical of Bob Knight, whatever it was, there was a time where, for example, he could make a cameo on a Saturday Night Live sketch, and I don't think you'd have to explain who he was to the majority of people. And that's not just sports fans. That's who he was. He had and I don't think this was necessarily by design. I don't think this was something he pursued, but the bigness of his personality, really outgrew his sport, frankly, in a lot of ways. And he was a brilliant coach. You know, there are people who I think would argue credibly and, you know, fervently that he may well have been the best basketball coach at any level of all time. He's certainly in that conversation. But there was also a cultural importance that he held both within and to the state of Indiana, and also, frankly, you know, within this country at large, that transcended just the fact that he was a basketball coach in a way that, like I said, thinking of other, you know, Vince Lombardi, Tiger Woods, Serena Williams, that there are sports figures that in some ways ultimately culturally rise above not just their sport, but sports in total. And I think he was one of those people. And I think it's hard for people to appreciate that if they didn't live through it, because time moves on and those figures are ultimately replaced in the cultural consciousness. And again, you know, I use this example with someone too. There's a wonderful show on Hulu called The Bear, and it takes place in Chicago. And there's a scene where Oliver Platt is explaining to another character, the Steve Bartman play. And he's explaining it as though they've never heard about it before. And I was watching that and I was thinking, why does he need to go into this much detail? And then it dawned on me that was 20 years ago. And there's a whole generation of people, probably even people from Chicago, that don't necessarily have the cultural reference to understand that moment and what it meant and its importance and its gravity in that time. You know, all this stuff moves on eventually, but I think it's important to remember on a day like this as much as any other. You know, at one time Bob Knight held that kind of fame, and it wasn't just in college basketball or just in basketball or even just in sports. He was a large American character. And I think that is something that shouldn't be forgotten.
Zach Osterman, the Indianapolis Star, at Zach Osterman on the Twitterverse, IndyStar.com. How did basketball, and that's the whole cultural phenomenon, how did basketball become that vehicle? Was it just simply the wins and losses, the undefeated season, the Olympics coach? Did that just, that decade from like 74 to... Well, I guess
I think there was also his personality. And again, This is wherever you fall on Bob Knight.
Yeah, we don't ask you to take a side.
Supportive of him, if you were critical of him, the point is you knew who he was. He was one of those people who had a personality, a charisma, when you hear people talk and you know, anyone who's listening who's never seen Bob Knight in the flesh, he's a very imposing figure. And I don't mean that in a mean way. He's just very tall.
He's 6'5" and 240 pounds, right?
Right. He's broad-shouldered. Yeah. He was a college athlete, and he looks like someone who was a college athlete. You know, he would walk into a room, and I think I saw Robbie Hummel talking about this, I think, on the Big Ten Network last night, and he said, you know, you don't realize until you're up next to Bob Knight just how large of a physical presence he is. you know, the his height, the broadness of his shoulders, the way he carries himself. And Hummel was talking about, I think, a time when Knight was calling one of his games at Purdue. So this is when Knight is, you know, still not very far removed from coaching and all those different kinds of things. You have to have the success for people to, you know, for people to pay attention, for people to care. That will always be part of it. And there, you know, there was from what, 1974 to at minimum 1987, maybe as far as 1993, there was a period in time when Bob Knight was as successful in his trade as basically any coach in any sport, in any team sport in America. Not just in terms of championships, but also in terms of the way his teams played, the way his teams were sort of identifiable, the influence he had on the sport, how many, you know, how much his methods, his systems, his, you know, his strategies and tactics informed the sort of young generation of coaches coming up behind him, all of those sorts of things. I don't think it's by accident that, you know, if we're having this conversation about who the greatest men's college coach of all time is, the coach with perhaps the greatest sort of argument against Knight or in place of Knight, played for Knight, coached for Knight, studied under Knight.
Mike Kay.
And I think it's always, there's always going to be an element of it's got to be successful on the floor. It's got to be, you know, whatever. You know, Mike Leach is remembered more than some other air raid disciples because Leach had the success, if you understand what I'm saying. Different sport, similar sort of, you know, I mean, to the fact, parallels to the fact that they literally worked at Texas Tech at the same time. But there was also just, again, the force of his personality, whether you liked him, whether you didn't, you could not avoid the magnetic nature of just Bob Knight's, I don't know, existence is not the right word.
But aura.
Yeah, he would walk into a room and I think, you know, or a gym or an arena, and it wouldn't just be like, oh, the really successful coach is here. I think it felt bigger than that.
And I think
more fundamental.
Right, and I think that has to do with his physical stature, as you accurately describe. Mike Krzyzewski's not a large man. Tom Izzo's not a large guy. This is a big guy. I don't know if you ever had a chance to meet John Thompson. He had that same effect. John Thompson was 6'10". He was enormous. And
you hear stories about, like, John Thompson talking to, you know, gang leaders in Washington, telling them to stay away from his players. That,
right.
You know, and they did. Like, that's a similar sort of John Thompson, actually, probably. I think I may have said Thompson didn't measure up to Knight in my podcast. To be honest, that's probably wrong. I think that Thompson, and I'm not picking on people here, but, you know, I don't know that fits John Boeheim or Jim Boeheim. I don't know if that fits Dean Smith in quite the same way. Maybe it does with Dean, but, you know,
it's John a different Thompson, cachet.
John Thompson wasn't just a basketball coach.
Right.
And Bob Knight was the same way, that when they walked in a room, or when they sat down in front of you, or when they spoke to you, or whatever it might have been, there was a gravity to it that outsized just the sport.
That makes sense. And a lot of things that Zach Osterman writes and says make sense. He joins us here on a Thursday, as he usually does. And we are reflecting and remembering the loss of Indiana basketball coach Bob Knight, 83 years of age, passing away at his home in Bloomington yesterday evening, surrounded by his family. And the messy divorce in 2000 was, it forced you to pick a side at the time. I know if we could all go back and do it over again, that probably wouldn't be the way that things would end, so to speak. But that, it's just another layer of the onion that's highly complicated. And I don't know if it's the type A personality, the driven to succeed, or whatever else it was. But I know we all have regrets. It was great when he came back a few years ago with the team and the Jackets, and he was introduced at the Purdue game and all of that. Could we have fixed that and finished that a little bit differently back then, or is that wound not worth reopening?
I don't know. I mean,
because of what you just said in that describing all of the things that got us to that point, having it end so abruptly, not properly, and I know this divides opinion, and I don't care. Get your own radio show if you want to talk about and you don't like Bob Knight. That's you're not getting that here today. Sorry. But
yeah,
there was a better way to handle things, and I think everyone
would do certain things differently just right. in life if they could have their time again.
Yeah, but this is bigger than life. You just described that. You just painted the picture.
No, I mean, that's fair to a point. I guess the other thing I want to be careful talking about some of this stuff, because some of these, you know, a fair few of the central figures in that particular story are no longer here to
defend.
To tell their own side.
Sure.
I don't even want to say defend themselves, because I don't want to sound like I'm picking
Let me
side.
Rephrase this then, because I think this is interesting. Did Indiana as a whole, university, athletics, whatever you want to label it as, did they as a whole get that right at the time? I would say no. I think they got it wrong.
I think with the clarity of years removed, I think probably a lot of people who were involved would say the same, that if things had been handled differently, if everyone could have their time again, there would have been ways to approach all of that that perhaps would have been that would have possibly led to better outcomes. But I think that, you know, that
it felt like we were in a hurry to get it taken care of, not remembering all the other things that got us to that point.
The other thing I would say, though, is what's the best way to put this? I think things like that are just kind of what you make of them. And, you know, I don't want to speak from Bob Knight's perspective, in the sense that I never spoke to him about any of that. He's made public comments on the record at different times. But I think the university struggled in the aftermath of all that to sort of find its footing. And, you know, the thing I any conversation about this sort of inexorably circles me back to that day in 2020 when he came back. And, you know, obviously he'd been to the baseball game the previous April, and, you know, quietly he had actually returned for a variety of private functions over the years, old friends at the university, things like that. But I think about that day, and honestly, the people that I remember feeling just as in from as objective of a position as you can be, and ultimately what is a very emotional day, whether it's emotional for you, it wasn't for me necessarily. I didn't grow up in Indiana like that, you know, but understanding the emotion that it invoked in a lot of people that day. I remember the group that I sort of felt, I don't know, most, I don't know that I don't want to say happy for, because I don't think that's quite what I'm trying to say, but it felt like a really important day for his players, because I don't think anybody ultimately at a personal level, we can talk about, you know, donors leaving and then coming back and all the sort of lingering stuff that held over Mike Davis and then the Kelvin Sampson things and all that. But I don't think there was at a personal one-to-one level, a group that probably suffered a lot of that in some ways. I'm sure in some ways Knight did. And I think he's in bits and pieces talked about, you know, the difficulty he had sort of getting over that at times. But his players for so long, essentially feeling like they had to choose between, you know, their head coach and their alma mater, and feeling like essentially if they chose one, they were, I don't want to say betraying the other, but I think a lot of them just felt very conflicted, you know, that they wanted to be able to honor both the man and the program. They wanted to still feel that strong sense of attachment to both, but as long as those two were so far apart, I think it always felt, in talking to those players, and I think Todd Leary even said this to Dana Bimbo, one of our reporters, on that day, that, you know, it felt like nobody had to choose anymore. Like, there, you know, a big sort of open gap in the circle of family had been closed. And I think that, again, I'm sure a lot of people would do it differently if they could have their time again. But the other part of it for me is I think just ultimately stuff like that in the end is what you make of it. And I think that the final outcome, I think there were, you know, the people who maybe deserved the most relief or the most, you know, satisfaction or happiness, I hope they found it anyway. Because that, you know, that was, I mean, I remember walking out of that building that day and just thinking, you know, you're never going to see that again. Like that, just all of the sort of cultural and personal forces in play in a moment like that, you're likely to see an intersection of that kind of emotion and history and, you know, just personal relationship and personal conflict, all of that sort of come together again. I just don't, it was a remarkable day, to be honest. And, I just, you know, I think the thing you hope most for everyone is that it did allow everyone to feel that this is such a blanket term that gets overused, but that almost that sense of closure.
Relief was the word I had as well, because the tension was palpable, and thankfully, finally, cooler heads prevailed, which brings me to my closing point here. What's next? I learned yesterday, being out and about, how many people don't know that the Simon Scott Assembly Hall court is already named for someone. What is the tribute moving forward for Coach Knight? That was another part of this healing process that I don't know if we ever had a roadmap to what we get to hear next, or do you put a statue up? Do you do this? Do you do that? What do you think should be, or what is being considered, if you know, moving forward?
Yeah, I think a lot of that's probably going to depend on the family's wishes. I don't think I'm speaking out of school when I say that at various times, you know, before the sort of public reconciliation, Indiana explored the possibility of putting Bob Knight's name on something, whether it was a practice facility or something else. I don't think.
Is that fitting enough?
I think Knight pretty consistently asked that not happen.
Okay.
Again, that was before, though, the you know, everyone that, to use a phrase I think I used on the day that all happened, that was kind of before the Cold War thawed. I think ultimately it will really come down to what his family wants. Obviously, of course, the family sort of was the first vehicle to announcing his passing. I think we've already seen, you know, today, last night, today, there have been a number of sort of tributes announced, a moment of silence, the patch, the decal, the patch on the jerseys, the decal on the helmets. And Indiana has pretty publicly sort of said anything else will just kind of follow the family's wishes. I would imagine there may come a time where Indiana says, you know, could we put a statue in Assembly Hall, or, you know, yes, name a building or a locker room or something. I'm not sure what. But I think my sense is Indiana will very much follow Knight's family's wishes on anything like that. And I don't think anything that permanent would come together. You know, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there'll be some sort of announcement tomorrow night at the Marion game. But I'd be kind of surprised if anything like that came together, you know, super quickly.
Patches on the jerseys, stickers on the helmets for the entire season. Weekend, I guess you would probably do all of it through there. I don't think that's just a one weekend thing. So you'll notice that if you're going tomorrow night, Indiana basketball against Marion, 6:30. Zach Osterman from the Indianapolis Star joins us every Thursday. As the old saying goes, the show must go on. And Indiana basketball does have a game to play tomorrow night. Marion, Steve Downing, one of Knight's favorite players and people on the planet, Mike Woodson, everybody will get together. That's going to be a very emotional game, I would think. Well, Steve Downing, obviously the athletics director, my old high school basketball assistant coach, Scott Hetty in charge of the Knights. What better place to bring everybody together to remember Coach Knight than the Simon Scott Assembly Hall?
Yeah, I mean, that's fair. And obviously two very prominent former Knight players on Indiana's bench as well. I don't know this for certain. I wouldn't be shocked if you don't see a bit of an impromptu reunion on Friday night. And listen, you might have seen that anyway, as you said, Steve Downing coming through. You've already got Mike Woodson as the head coach, Calvert Chaney on staff. So, I mean, there's your impromptu reunion right there. You know, three guys who played for Knight at three pretty distinct times in his tenure.
And three pretty good players.
Yeah, three of his best players as well. But I think, again, I think so much of this is, in terms of like what Indiana really pulls together in a formal way, rather than just sort of, if a whole bunch of former Knight players just kind of get together and say, hey, it's Friday night, Mike's already down there, Steve's already down there, Calvert's already down there, let's just get some tickets. Let's all go down there. Let's be together, et cetera. If it happens organically, that's one thing. I do think in terms of formal stuff, my sense is Indiana wants to be very deferential to the family in terms of sort of saying, again, there'll be a moment's silence. The patches are going to be on the jerseys all season. That's not just a Friday night thing. But again, just sort of a desire to sort of not want to do anything that the family wouldn't want done. So, I'll be curious to see again if anything maybe organic develops. And I'm sure fans will have their say. They can chant his name. They can, I don't know if we're still doing signs in Assembly Hall, to be honest with you. I haven't seen anybody hold up a sign in a while, but right. I'd be surprised if they're taking them away as long as they're not getting in anybody's way. All those kinds of tributes. Obviously, we saw some flowers and candles and, of course, amusingly, a chair placed in front of that plaque in the south entrance to Assembly Hall. I think a lot of that's just going to be organic, and Indiana will just not want to do anything, understandably, that maybe the family would not want to happen.
Let's talk hoops, shall we? One exhibition game in the books. Indiana will be better on January 1st than they will be on November 1st. A lot of new faces, a lot of new roles. Life without TJD, but Xavier Johnson's back. The one thing that jumped off the page to me while rewatching that scrimmage from Sunday, scrimmage exhibition game against the University of Indianapolis, that team covers the court up and down, side to side, above the rim. That's something that I don't remember a lot of Indiana teams in the last 25 years. That's really stuck out to me. What did you take away from Sunday?
I mean, first of all, they looked like a team that really didn't know how to play together in that setting, and that's not surprising. You can have your summer, your preseason, your off season, your open gyms, all that. It's just different. Any athlete in any sport will tell you it is just different when it's, the lights are on, the scoreboard's on, nobody's stopping it to switch things up. It's not situational. It's just like tip it up for 40 minutes basketball, and if the shot doesn't go in, you don't get to take a quick water break. It's just total live goes. I think Zion Brown brought this up on our podcast, and I noticed it too, and I thought it was a good example. It was the best one I could think of, where Xavier Johnson's leading, I think, like a 3-on-1 break, and McKenzie and Bacos to his left, and they hit the free. Johnson hits about the 3-point line, maybe even the free throw line, and Mbako starts to float to the corner, and it's a perfectly sensible thing to do. Mbako's a good 3-point shooter. He is, to use the old Red Auerbach phrase, he's the corner man. He's thinking, I'm going to be wide open. There's nobody with me. I'm going out for this corner three. That's my shot. And Xavier Johnson throws a lob at the rim, and it goes out of bounds. and it's just kind of one of those, like, no matter how many times you might have done this in open gym, no matter how many times you might have worked on this in practice, there's just an instinctive chemistry that only comes with playing games. And I think you can see that is still clearly building. And that's why I've said many times, I think the first couple months of the season could be rough at times, could be fascinating, could be a real work in progress kind of thing. I think it's good for Indiana that they are going to have a pretty tough November, December. I think that is healthy for this team, even if they get roughed up a little bit, because I think that you want to be able to work through a lot of that stuff as quickly as possible to get this team, which, you know, with multiple guys who could be draft prospects next year, with Xavier Johnson, you know, forever and I out of eligibility after the season, this team, which is not going to be together for very long, you want to make sure you're not wasting any time figuring out what needs fixed, what needs tweaked, what needs thrown away, what needs replaced, whatever, to get this team in the right place for January, February, March. In the same breath, as you said there, I can't remember an Indiana team this long. I can't remember an Indiana team in terms of short space quickness that looked quite this athletic. In terms of the ability to like jump passing lanes, skip closeouts.
They just cover a ton of ground.
Yeah, and I mean, it's one of those things where, like, for example, McKenzie Mbako got burned on a three early in the first half where he kind of overhelped, tried to recover on just kind of a skip over top from one wing or one sort of, however you want, free throw line extended, however you kind of want to see that sort of wing area behind the three-point line, one to the other. UIndy hit a three over top of him. And you think, okay, you know, that's a defensive breakdown. But then, and I think I even said to you, I said, you know, oh, that was a rough moment for Mbako defensively. But then the thing was, UIndy tried it like four more times and they didn't score on it again. And the reason they didn't is because, hey, great, you made the first three. Your legs are still under you. You're not tired yet. You know, you're still playing on the adrenaline of it's Assembly Hall and this is great. What a venue. What a moment in my career. But then 10 minutes later, you're tired because they're athletic as heck and because they've been pestering you and they've been gambling for steals and you can't go anywhere with the ball because no matter who you get switched on to, either they're faster than you or they're longer than you or they're more athletic than you or some combination of all three. And so, hey, great. You got the skip over McKenzie Mbako again. But here he comes. He's 6'8", 6'9", with arms as long as can be. And now you don't have your legs anymore. And it's a reminder sometimes that in a sport that is as high sample size as basketball, there, you know, you can have any given possession look bad for a player, for a team. But what Mike Woodson might say is, and I'd have to go back to watch the film to know exactly how many, but let's say it was five. What Mike Woodson might say is, you know, they did that to us on five possessions and they scored on one. And yeah, that one possession, McKenzie Mbako looked a little lost. He wasn't. He was doing what he was supposed to do, but he looked bad. But the other four, which you didn't notice because they were just bad misses that led to runouts, it worked exactly like it was supposed to. And if I had played a 70-possession game, and that's roughly what the UIndy game was, about 70 possessions each way, and they're only doing something good on one out of every five, we're going to be fine.
Pretty good rate of return.
That is where I think this team can really, really, if it continues to round into form and stays healthy, that's always part of the deal, this team I think can really be a problem for a lot of teams defensively, because you've already, you know, you know, I don't, Khalil Ware is probably not going to have the same prolific sort of numbers blocking shots as Trayce Jackson Davis, but you're still not going to want to take the ball at him. He's 7'2". You're still not going to want to, you know, Malik Renew in there defending without fouling, hoovering up rebounds. Peyton Sparks is a unit. Obviously it seems like he might be out for just a little while with maybe an ankle deal or whatever it is. But you're still facing some of the same stuff that we saw Indiana struggle with last year, opponent struggle with last year, which is you don't want to take it all the way to the rim because that's not going to be an easy finish. So you're going to settle for some jumpers. But the more jumpers you settle for, the fewer good shots you're taking, the lower your percentages. You might get a few more rebounds here and there, and that's an area where I think Indiana may feel like it can and needs to improve this year with a longer, more athletic team. But this defense can make things, I think, very hard on people as long as it continues to evolve.
Yeah, and imagine when they get their principles dialed in as well, because the natural athletic ability is there. And then when you get doing what Mike Woodson really wants him to get doing, that's going to turn into offense. And now we talk about offense. Didn't shoot it great from three. We've harped on this for as long as I can remember. It doesn't look like that quote-unquote issue is solved. Is that something we should be concerned about, or is that something they will find with more in transition, with offensive rebounds? It's not a focal point of Mike Woodson's offense, as he told us after the game.
I do think it's one of those things that's you've seen enough of Indiana probably not shooting, maybe not even not making enough threes, not shooting enough threes, that you do sort of say, well, I'm going to believe it's not a problem when you prove it's not a problem. I mean, Indiana as a team was 39th in the country in three-point shooting percentage last year. In Big Ten play alone, they were third. They hit 38% of their threes. That was actually better than their season-wide number. And we did this all the time. You know, they were 354th nationally in three-point attempts as an overall percentage of field goal attempts.
Right.
They were 345th nationally in points scored off three-pointers. So it's less about not making enough. And, like, listen, 30, you know, they were 3 of 10. 30% is not a good number, obviously, if you extrapolate across the course of a whole season shooting threes. If they'd hit one more, we'd say, wow, 40%. If you do that all season, you'll be great.
Sample size. Always a reminder. Sample size.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I remember going back to some of those Archie Miller teams and saying, you know, you realize the difference between them shooting like 32% and 35% is basically just like one more three every 60 minutes or right. something like that. Like
9 out of 30 sounds way better than 3 out of 10 because you've made 9 and scored 27 points.
Right. The issue for Indiana is volume, and is, can you get to a place where you can put enough volume up? Now, listen. If you, against better opponents, can still score 22 fast break points a half, and you can just get out and run and just rim run because you're bigger and longer and more athletic than everybody else, then more power to you. Don't take the threes. The twos are, you know, I know Mike Woodson takes criticism for saying that the twos sometimes are better than the threes, but, like, twos are usually higher percentage shots, especially if you're getting them in transition. But it's less about, I think, three-point accuracy for me, and more about, we just need to see Indiana, which has, for not just Woodson's tenure, but really the last 5 or 6 years, not been able to find a way to get enough three-point volume into its offense. You just kind of need to see it happen before you can say, okay, yeah, that's great. That's what they need, and that's what it's going to look like, and they'll be fine. But the flip side is, you know, you look at this starting five. If we just kind of take it as, you know, at face value, or not face value, but we take the starting five we saw against Marion as the likely starting five, you know, if everybody's fit and everything moving forward. Xavier Johnson can shoot threes. Trey Galloway can shoot threes. Khalil Ware can shoot threes. Mackenzie Mbaka can shoot threes. Time will tell on Malik Renew, but he's been trying, and I think he's got good form. But my point is, it may be something where the volume creeps into the offense just on the sheer fact that you've got enough guys that are comfortable letting one go that, you know, you'll get 19, 20 attempts a night. No one player will take more than four, but, you know, seven different guys will try one, if you understand what I'm saying.
I always understand what you're saying. Zach Osterman, the Indianapolis Star. Bench was good, trying to merge the two units, trying to find guys who could play. No Caleb Banks, no Ja'Kai Newton. We'll worry about injuries down the road. Again, this is exhibition basketball. Marion, the final exhibition game, will kick it off for real Tuesday. The season opener, Florida Gulf Coast, 6:30, Big Ten Network. The Indiana Hoosiers take to the court. Before we let you go, buddy, we got to get to the little bit of football. Indiana is in, we talk all September and all October, and there's not really any must-win games. Well, here we are on the first Saturday of November, and it is a must-win game because it's a math win game. There are four opportunities left. Indiana is 2-6, and to become bowl eligible, they must win four in a row. Wisconsin limps into town quite literally and figuratively. Can it start? Can November, can this be the movement that we hope Wisconsin, Illinois, Michigan State, yeah, Purdue.
Obviously, it is, as you say, to use one of my favorite phrases, last chance saloon in one way. If you don't win this game, it's off the table for good. There's also an element, I think, of you're coming off maybe your best performance of the season. Yes, you lost, and there are things I think to be critical of, even in, you know, given the environment, given the opponent, et cetera. But Indiana looked good for long stretches of that Penn State game. And you can say, well, they scored two touchdowns and coverage breakdowns. You know what? They still scored them.
They count.
Yeah, they count for an offense. That's the first time in how long, I think almost a year of Big Ten games, that offense has scored more than two touchdowns in regulation. So, like, it looks better. They played better. Is it, you know, can you prove that it is more than just sort of like, hey, a bad team shows up every once in a while in a game where basically it's playing with no pressure? There was no expectation for Indiana to win. They were a 4-score underdog, or maybe even more than that by the time the game kicked off. And they just went out and played, you know, with just zero concern for what the consequences might be. Or can you, against, as you say, a Wisconsin team that is, you know, has had some good moments this season, hasn't necessarily just, you know, gotten into fifth gear consistently in Luke Fickell's first year, and is now going to be coming in with some very real injury concerns. Can you carry on the positive parts of your performance against Penn State and maybe find a way to beat a bit of a wounded Wisconsin team here? And it's one of those where, on the one hand, a lot of the time, let's be honest, when a team that's 2-6 puts in a performance like the one they did against Wisconsin, it's not something that is sustainable, in the sense that, you know, if those kinds of teams were capable of being more consistent, they wouldn't be 2-6. I'm not trying to be flippant, but that's just, you know, kind of what history tells us. On the other hand, if Indiana can build on this, Wisconsin is vulnerable, is possibly there for, you know, ripe for an upset. Then if you can go to Illinois next week, and you know, you're playing an Illinois team that has had a season not unlike yours in terms of maybe some disappointing results and certain things that they'd hoped kind of would click into place never really come into fruition. If you can find a way to win that game, well, then suddenly you've won two in a row, and you're coming home to play a Michigan State team that is obviously deeply flawed, and there's all kinds of things going on up there. But that's senior day, and you're back at home, and it's a trophy game. And then if you win that game, you're 5-6 going into the Purdue game, and it's all in your hands. And there's a lot that has to happen there. And again, I think history would tell us it's unlikely that particular confluence of events comes to you know, becomes reality. But there is a path if Indiana's improvement against Penn State was not a flash in the pan, but something that this team can improve upon against opponents that are weaker and more vulnerable and less capable than Penn State. That's right. Where I think Indiana is.
You're not impressing the tournament committee with your resume. You just have to get to 6 by hook or by crook. It's also hard for folks, and I understand why, to extrapolate how you're going to win 4 in a row when you haven't won 2 in a row. Well, you have to start with 1 in a row on Saturday and go 1-0 each week, just like the coaches tell you. So it's really not anything different or any different message. But Tom did earlier on Thursday told us the level of expectancy and urgency has been dialed up. Well, it should be. Some will argue, why did we wait till November? But young quarterback, knew this, knew that, a lot of new faces. Did this thing just take some time to gel?
Possibly. I mean,
learn more on Saturday, that's for sure.
Right. I mean, I think that's, I mean, Saturday in so many ways just kind of feels like the ultimate kind of test of all of this, you know, and if Indiana can string a couple wins together here, then suddenly you're a little bit more justified in the way you've handled the offense, the way you've handled the quarterback, the way you've sort of navigated. We always knew the back end of Indiana's schedule was going to be lopsided, you know, or was going to, that Indiana's schedule was very front loaded. You know, Maryland, Michigan, Ohio State, Penn State, et cetera, Louisville. But the question was always, you know, could Indiana keep itself together such that it could attack that back half of the schedule, or that end part of the schedule, in a meaningful way. That's what we're going to find out Saturday.
Great job, buddy. I know you have a very busy, busy week continues to get busier and busier and busier. We always appreciate you checking in. And then next week, heck, we will have more clues on football. We'll have a basketball game, or an official basketball game to talk about as well. It's a busy time of year, and we always appreciate you fitting us in. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, as always, Glenn.
That's my buddy, Zach Osterman from the Indianapolis Star, at IndyStar.com, at Zach Osterman. Indiana Hoops getting ready to tip off at 6:30, hosting Marion. And at 7:30 tonight, busy night at the complex, the old sports campus, Indiana men's soccer. The number one seeded Indiana Hoosiers will take on the Wisconsin Badgers. Kick time at Bill Armstrong Stadium, Jerry Eagley Field, 7:30. So you basketball fans, if it's 60-10 at halftime, get on over to soccer. Cheer on the Hoosiers as they look to add another title to their collection. Regular season co-champions, the first of hopefully three in a row at home to win the Big Ten tournament as well. Best of luck. We heard from Coach Eagley earlier. Best of luck, Todd and his crew, tonight as well. So a busy weekend. Basketball, soccer. You've got football tomorrow, noon, on the Big Ten Network. Wisconsin and IU. We'll have the Pacers for you on Saturday night. Pregame at 6:30. We'll tip it at 7 against the Hornets. And Sunday afternoon, the Colts. Now listen up, kids. The Colts play at 4 o'clock in Charlotte against the Carolina Panthers. That means the Neil Tyer pregame show and the Neil Tyer Radio Network will rev up at 3 o'clock on Sunday. It's the first time we have not had a 1 p.m. kickoff or a noon pregame all season long. It'll be the first of two in a row. Colts go to Germany next week. Yes, we'll be with you 8:30 for a 9:30 kick on the 12th. So a busy weekend, and we'll wrap it up, joined in progress with the Bills and Bengals on Sunday Night Football. Have a fantastic weekend. We're back. We'll take care of a full week of November next week, and hopefully we'll get warmed up as well. Have a great Friday. IHSAA Sectional 15, the title game, South and Seymour. We'll get started in about a half an hour. Tune in, Joe Smith and Dave Novak, and we'll get our Friday off to a winning start on the football field as well. Have a great Friday. Have a great weekend. The Glass in the Afternoon radio program is over.